Good morning, Maine. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLLB. We're on AM and FM, aren't we, Deb?
We sure are.
How do you feel about being on FM? It's a clearer signal. It goes a little bit further.
It goes a lot further.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Our listening audience, I think, has jumped from 2 to 3 people.
I think it might have jumped
picked,
to 5.
5?
Yes.
You know, times 1,000 is what you mean. And because we're on the internet, there's billions listening, so
that's
people
right.
are all over.
There you go.
We've got quite a show. We have 2 separate interviews coming up in just a few seconds. We have Sharon Bates, who is the CEO of the Anthony Bates Foundation, named for her son.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing some really good work creating awareness and really putting attention on a condition that I think people will find very, very interesting. And then right after that, we have Florence Ann Romano, who wrote a book about being a nanny.
Yeah.
It's a children's book, which I think is an interesting approach. And she is known as the Windy City Nanny. So she called in from Chicago.
Yes, indeed.
So if you're interested, that'll be coming up after our talk with Sharon Bates. But why don't we get to that? Thank you for listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB. And here's our interview with Sharon Bates.
Hope when you take that jump, you don't feel the fall. Hope when the water rises, you built a wall. Hope when the crowd screams out, you're screaming your name. Hope if everybody runs, you choose to stay.
Welcome back to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk, WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5 FM. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Sharon Bates. Welcome to the show, Sharon.
Thank you, Steve.
You're from away, as we say here in Maine. Pretty much everyone who wasn't born here is away, but you really flew in from being away in Arizona, right?
Phoenix, Arizona, the hot part of the country.
Yeah, we could use some of that heat. We had snow here just a couple of weeks ago.
I know, so. I brought my coat, just in case.
Just in case? So you're trying to bring on the cold weather. It's your fault. Well, welcome to the show. I want to talk about, you have a foundation that you had set up years ago for your late son, and it's a serious medical condition that I think is worthy of lots of discussion and understanding. But before we get to that, why don't we talk a little bit about your background in terms of setting up the organization? And if you wouldn't mind talking briefly about your son, Anthony Bates, who the foundation is named for, and the history. And then we'll talk about what the foundation, the work that's being done and the research that's needed and the awareness that we hope to generate.
Well, how much time do we have?
We have as much time. Sully is here. She gets paid by the day. So Sully's here till midnight, right?
All day.
So we've got plenty of time.
All right.
So talk a little bit about the background. My understanding is that one of the most tragic experiences any parent can face mm-hmm. is losing a child. And so I had been to your website, and I've read much of the history. But if you wouldn't mind sharing kind of the history of what happened with your son and then how that led you to the point where you recognized the need that many parents should be more aware of.
Well, unfortunately, my son is my only child. When he was a little boy, I was a PTA president. When he got into high school, I was a booster club president. And so I was kind of in training on fundraising and organizing events. And unbeknownst to me, that's where I would end up in my life's work. Anthony went to Kansas State University on a scholarship when he was 19 years old. And when he was 20, he had a sudden cardiac arrest. And it turned out he had a hidden condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, an enlarged heart. The same thing that Hank Gathers died from, the same thing Reggie Lewis died from, and many other sports figures. But he was in college, and so he didn't have that notoriety of where he was, other than the fact that he was at Kansas State University. And Bill Snyder, Coach Snyder, is the coach there still today, and he asked me to do screenings. And when a Division I coach asks you to do something, what do you say?
Right.
I said yes. I don't know how, but I'll do it.
So the background is, this is back in 2000? Correct. Is that right?
July of 2000.
July of 2000. And I know you're not necessarily a doctor, but you're certainly very familiar with the condition and it's affected your family. But technically, to the extent that you know, what is HCM and specifically how does it, is it the enlargement of a part of the heart that reduces blood flow or what is it? And then we'll talk a little bit about why there's such a need for particularly maybe student athletes that are putting more stress on their hearts that may be more susceptible.
Well, the big problem about HCM is it's a genetic condition. It's congenital, so you're born with it. And supposedly it's also passed on from family member to family member. So if your mom or dad has it, 50% of the children could potentially have it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a death sentence. Just because you have HCM doesn't mean you're going to die. The good news is we have great technologies and great doctors in our country that can help care for somebody with HCM. It is a condition that will cause enlargement in your heart, usually on the left side, of course. And it will also cause shortness of breath, chest pains, heart palpitations. But it will also show up with electrical problems in the heart. And so that's another reason why in our screening program, we use EKGs and ultrasounds to find HCM in young people.
And in the case of your son, after passing away, the autopsy showed his heart was 3 times the size of the normal heart?
Correct. It was heavy. It was thick and heavy. And that's what the HCM does, is it thickens up the heart muscle and then causes electrical problems as well because you have a thicker muscle
right. And
the electrical pathways can't get through as easily. And then, of course, it has issues with pumping blood and all kinds of problems related to that. But just because you have an enlarged heart doesn't mean you're going to have an enlarged heart that's 3 times the normal size. If we find somebody with an enlarged heart that's 13 years old instead of 20, they could get beta blockers, medications, and ways to keep their heart under a control so that it doesn't push into an enlarged state.
Let's talk about the foundation, the Anthony Bates Foundation that you've started in name and honor of your son. By the way, the website is anthonybates.org. And what was the genesis for starting the website and what is really the focus and mission now? And then let's talk about where screenings could really, going forward, really impact and save lives, future lives going forward.
Well, the reason that I started the foundation, obviously, was because my son had passed away and I didn't want to just plant a tree. I wanted to do something. He was an Eagle Scout. And when you're an Eagle Scout, your parents are trained as well to be scouts. And you have to make this world a better place. And that's one of the mottos of scouting and one of the efforts and emphasis of being a scout. And so I knew that I had to do something. I had to put this into action. And part of that action is to raise awareness. At the time when Anthony died, there were only 2 other organizations doing heart screenings. Only 2. There are 64 million children in this country, and 2 organizations, or 3, including the Anthony Bates Foundation, couldn't do it all. And so in 2005, I also created a training program that trained other organizations across the country and the world to do heart screenings.
When you said there were only a couple, why is that? I mean, when people get physicals and student athletes, my wife and I have 3 kids, and currently our youngest, Zach, in fact, in 1 hour from now, will be playing in a varsity lacrosse game. So when I read your story and the history of the foundation, I was both moved by the work you're doing and also interested relative to my own experience as a parent of a student athlete. So in most programs, most high school programs and certainly college programs, there are all, and if kids go away to summer camp, there's different levels of screening, of testing, of making sure each camper or student athlete has blood work, has testing done. Why hasn't the heart received kind of the attention relative to either an EKG or ultrasound that may be able to prevent some of these kind of tragic deaths?
Well, there's a couple reasons. First off, with just only 2 organizations doing screenings, we were at a point in the year 2000, the technology wasn't there. We didn't have the technology prior to Anthony's death to actually do mobile screenings. And then that became available to us through the growth of the foundation and growth of more foundations that wanted to do screenings. So having the mobility was important. Having the technology was important. And the third reason why we couldn't do screenings in our country, at least prior to that, was resources. We didn't have enough doctors. We don't have enough pediatric cardiologists in our country to support a mass screening across the nation right now. We only have 2,500 pediatric cardiologists.
Wow.
And there are 64 million children. And my numbers in the data that I'm pulling from the screenings are anywhere from 10 to 20% of the people that come through our screenings have heart problems that they don't know about.
And undiagnosed heart problems.
Right, right. And so if we extrapolated that all the way up to 64 million, that's 6.4 million people to be seen by 2,500 pediatric cardiologists that are already overworked. Right. So we need more doctors.
We have Sharon Bates here. She's the founder of the Anthony Bates Foundation, named for her son who passed away from this issue, HCM. And anthonybates.org is the website. Is there anything, are there any criteria or is there anything about this condition that's more particular prevalent with male, female, with athletes? You know, in the case of your son, it came up while he was, you know, practicing, I think going home after practice or something, and he had a cardiac event, which later on they determined was because of this. But is there anything more native to athletes, or is this just something that it shows up or it's more easily diagnosed? You mentioned, the basketball players, Hank Gathers and Reggie Lewis, mm-hmm. that NBA fans may be familiar with. But is it just more, is there more awareness about athletes when this happens, or is it just across the board?
Well, unfortunately, all children have a risk factor of a heart disease if we're not checking.
Right.
So we have to be checking these kids for it. What I've also seen is some recent papers that were written by the Institute of Medicine that claims that 12,500 children suffer a sudden cardiac arrest every year. That's 30 a day. We also have another paper written by Dr. Dresner, University of Washington, that claims every 3 days we lose a high school athlete in this country. So that means 90 children have to suffer a sudden cardiac arrest in order for one high school athlete to make the news and underreport this huge tragedy and public health issue.
And one of the things you're pushing for and that you've done locally in your area in Arizona was introducing screenings or providing the opportunity for screenings. How did that start and what type of research? You know, when did it start? And out of the number of screenings that have taken place, what are some of the rough percentages in terms of identifying either young adults that have some sort of risk? And I'm sure the diagnosis has to be pretty limited to, you know, a radiologist or a pediatric cardiologist looked at it and said, you should really go see your doctor. So you may not have exact medical records. But what have you found since embarking on some localized screening or regional screening that you've done out west?
Well, I have screening results for 11,257 people, and 1,426 of those have been found to have a problem. That's, in the math, 12%. 1 in 8 people that go through our screenings have a problem. And half of those problems are life-threatening. Half. So 700 people plus that I've saved.
That's,
from the screening.
That's a huge number. And talk a little bit about where and how the screenings have taken place. And you mentioned there's two either approved diagnostic methods, either EKG, where people I think are familiar, where that's not my field, but
electrical
current or electric pads are placed during, you know, across the body where there's contact points, and then electrical current goes through, and then that shows the resistance through the heart muscle, and then ultrasound is more of
a picture of your heart,
a picture of sonar. So which of those is a more accurate diagnostic tool for this?
We like to use both. And the reason we like to use both is because we're finding other problems with those people that have heart problems. We find valve problems when we look at the structure of the heart, but we also confirm what the EKG would be saying, whether or not they have athlete's heart or HCM. So there's always that, if you have an enlarged heart that's concentric, that's enlarged all the way around, that could be considered athlete's heart, but you don't have HCM. So you don't want to
What is athlete's heart for listeners that may not be familiar with that term?
Well, athlete's heart is when your heart is enlarged all the way around, not just on the left side, consistently all the way around, because you are an athlete. And you may have a stronger pulse of energy through your heart as well. And the doctor can confirm that it's athlete's heart by telling you to stop being an athlete for 6 months. Well, that's not always good when you're in high school and you're in your senior year. And what you can also see that if you're looking with ultrasound and seeing, you can see the structure of the heart is consistently enlarged. And so you can, as a doctor, say whether or not, well, we don't need to confirm this by pulling you out of sports for 6 months.
And prior to your son's cardiac event that led to his death, were there any symptoms that you were aware of as his parent? Did he indicate anything? I saw a quote from you mentioning that at one point he was tired or he didn't think he was running as fast or something like that.
That was 3 days before he died.
But there's no symptoms that parents should look for if you don't go through the actual screening test, right?
Well, there are symptoms, but they're also masked to other problems with children as they grow and develop. If you're tired or dizzy or short of breath, that could be because of a lot of different reasons. But if you have chest pains and you faint or you have blackouts, that's something to be aware of. But you could also have those same problems because you pulled a muscle in your chest when you're lifting weights, or you fainted because you didn't eat breakfast. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why. And so you have these simple reasons for having to be watching for, but they could be also something masked in just growing and being a teenager.
Okay, we have Sharon Bates here. She's the founder of the Anthony Bates Foundation, named for her son, anthonybates.org. So talk about the work, if you wouldn't mind, of the Anthony Bates Foundation and why it was set up. What's the mandate? You have a number of sponsors. You're active in trying to spread the word about screenings being effective and life-saving. And then what's the future goal for the anthonybates.org?
Well, the really exciting thing that's happening now because of our training program is there are organizations across the country that have screening programs in their communities. So if you live in Maine or you live in Massachusetts or you live in someplace on the East Coast, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go to Arizona to get your heart checked. I have friends all over the country that are doing screenings. There are 350 organizations or more that are doing screenings, including some hospitals. So the partnership that we have with the screening organizations across the country is wonderful, as well as we have some medical programs that really are excited about what we're doing. Duke University and the CSRC, which stands for Cardiac Safety Research Consortium, they are partnering with the Anthony Bates Foundation and the screening organizations across the country to mandate, not necessarily mandate, but to actually have a position paper on screenings in our country and build best practices for us, too.
Is there anything more focused on student athletes versus the entire universe of students?
Yes, because the NCAA. They mandated that their college African-American basketball players get screened this year, which is kind of a little backwards thinking.
I wasn't aware of that. So the entire NCAA.
Right. At Division I level only.
D1.
Right.
If you're a D1 athlete. And I think most of our listeners are aware those are the larger universities which have scholarships available, and there's other criteria that make a school D1. So that is specific to African-American athletes, male and female?
Just male.
Just male.
Right now. But what happens if your white basketball player dies, or if a girl suffers a sudden cardiac arrest and she's an equestrian? I mean, that opens up risk factors for them beyond just protecting themselves.
What was the rationale of the NCAA? I haven't read the paper, but there must be, a little bit of controversy when they make it
so
focused on one group. Once you recognize there's a disease state or a risk, it's kind of unusual to say, well, let's focus on this group and other people may also have risk, maybe statistically to a lesser degree. But if it's your child that is harmed through this, then it doesn't matter what the statistic is, right?
Well, the history on that is a year ago at the think tank with Duke University and the CSRC, the NCAA was at the table, and they and Dr. Heinlein wanted to mandate it for all their Division I athletes, but the pushback was from the sports doctors. They don't know who's going to read the EKGs. They don't know how the EKGs are going to get done. They pushed back. And so then pilot program for the NCAA was, well, let's go after the highest risk athletes, which is male basketball players, and particularly African-American male basketball players. So they'll probably do the whole team because there's 9 or 12 players right. for male basketball. But many of the colleges are already doing their – universities are already doing their own screenings, which is helpful. Like Kansas State University, Anthony Bates Foundation goes there every year and screens all their athletes.
Up until hearing your story and in the story of your son who passed away in 2000, I wasn't aware of this. And as a basketball fan, and I'm involved in basketball, I used to be an NBA agent. I'm now one of the co-owners of an NBA team here in town. So I'm certainly familiar with Hank Gathers and Reggie Lewis. But there isn't enough discussion about this, whether it's the college level or secondary school level.
Right.
And
right.
so what I think what you're doing is amazing. So relative to screenings, if there was an athletic director or a school superintendent listening to this broadcast, and whether it's a statewide initiative or whether it's a local municipality, what would you advocate for, whether it's a college or a high school? And what would the steps they would need to take in terms of doing screenings? You know, work with a local medical group or if there's some sort of mobile unit, which would be great. Mm-hmm. But what should or could schools do and how many steps are really taken to do the screening that's necessary?
Well, the first thing that they need to do is to protect themselves by having automatic external defibrillators in their schools to make sure that they're, just in case a sudden cardiac arrest happened, they're covered. And they have an emergency plan to protect themselves and to get that student into the right care.
Right.
Secondly, on the screenings, if they have a local hospital that would be willing to come to their school and do the screenings, that would be fabulous. You still have rural areas that don't have cardiologists, and that's one of the problems that the NCAA felt, is that their schools were too spread out and they didn't have enough resources. Back to those, how many doctors are there out there that can actually do these screenings for the student athletes? I mean, when you're in college, you're above 18, so you can get adult cardiologists. But when you're in high school, we're talking about the pediatric cardiologists, then there aren't enough.
It's also, my understanding, is really a two-part process. In order to do these types of tests, you need somebody either as a radiologist or somebody administering the test, and then somebody qualified to read the results of the test. And that's absolutely part science, but it's part art mm-hmm. relative and to how these EKG and ultrasound are interpreted, because mm-hmm. with somebody not knowing what they're doing, they may not see something. They may not see something in a sine wave, or they may not see something on one of the leads. So that's probably part of the resistance too. It's not like simple blood test or glucose or cholesterol, right. which is straightforward. But if knowing from your research, if approximately 10% of people and student athletes or athletes have some sort of cardiac issue going on and they're not being diagnosed and they're not being seen, whether it's mm-hmm. there's surgical needs or whether or not there's medical or beta blockers or something.
Medicines can be very wonderful for athletes.
So what's the future goal now as the foundation and your work grows and, you know, your home base is in Arizona and here you are in Maine? That's we don't get a lot of people from Arizona. So
I'm here in Maine because I see the value of screening 10 million high school athletes in our country. We have to get the kids early into the right care. And with Duke University and the CSRC and TeleMed also and the technologies that are available, we can screen all those kids. It may take us a little while, you know. We're not going to do it all in a weekend.
TeleMed, what you're referring to, is having a screening set up at a location and then having those files digitized and having somebody that doesn't necessarily have to be there
Correct. Look
at the results, Right. Interpret, and then send back the alert. You need to either go right to the ER or you need to see your physician or you need to see a cardiologist locally because there could be something there, right?
Right, right. And part of that is you have to get those red flags into the care of those 2,500 pediatric cardiologists and or the adult cardiologist that can help. But first off, when we have screenings and we find a red flag, a screening result, we ask them to go to their family doctor first.
Right.
And redo the tests and make sure that the tests were done appropriately. I mean, I'm not saying that we're perfect, but we are also doing a screening. Just like when you, well, you're not a woman, but women have mammograms and other screening programs,
right,
and they get false positives too. And they go in for another test just to make sure that, oh, that's not anything to worry about. It's not the big C. It becomes the, oh, that was a blip on the radar. And that's better than dying.
Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for being here today. I think this is really interesting information. Mm-hmm. And I think that as a parent myself, it's unimaginable for any parent to contemplate losing their child, and in your case, your only child. But the work that you're doing in the name of your son and the work that you're doing to help so many other young men and young women is unbelievable in the name of your son. So yeah, as a parent, thank you for the work that you're doing, and I hope that we hear more about what's going on there at the Anthony Bates Foundation. You can go to anthonybates.org for information. And we'd love to have you come back sometime soon.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you so much. That was Sharon Bates, founder of Anthony Bates Foundation. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5. We'll be back.
Stay tuned for more of Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB.
GEICO applauds your inner road champion.
A solid bump from Geico's fist to yours goes out to the little rebel that lives within. The one who made you daydream as a kid about owning a chopper, chroming it out, and chewing on toothpicks. Just to look tough. For you, champ, Geico insures motorcycles with great rates. And to further fuel your engine, you can access your policy anytime, day or night, through the Geico mobile app. Because Geico knows that even make-believe renegades need help from time to time.
Geico Motorcycle. See how much you could save.
Want this choice position, have a cheery disposition, rosy cheeks, no warts.
That's the part I put in.
Play games, all sorts. You must be kind, you must be witty, very sweet and very pretty.
Of all the ridiculous ideas.
Wow, Deb, this is my favorite song.
Isn't it great?
Isn't it? I think our listeners may recognize it as Mary Poppins music.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that's the theme intro for our guest. Welcome back to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB. Please join me in welcoming Florence Ann Romano. She's on the phone, I believe, from Chicago. Hello, Florence Ann.
Hello, hello. It's so great to talk to you from the Windy City.
Have you ever been introduced with Mary Poppins music?
You know, I have, but never that portion of the song. And I was just smiling the whole time. I just love it.
Well, that is the theme. And you wrote a book a little while back called Nanny and Me, talking about some of your experiences. And before we get into your book and Mary Poppins and all that, I'm always interested in, as we have new guests, talking about their background that kind of led them to their area of interest or expertise. So talk a little bit about where you grew up and what led to you writing the book, and then we'll talk about the world of being a nanny and some other things.
I grew up in Chicago and in the western suburbs, and I have kind of an odd path that led me to where I am today, but I started as a mother's helper when I was about 11 years old, and I just loved children from the moment I was born. I actually would ask my mom to take me to the hospital to get my baby, and by hospital, I meant the toy store.
Wow.
And I would come home with my new baby doll, and I would write them birth certificates. I'd make birth certificates for my babies. I just loved taking care of children. So becoming a mother's helper at 11 was really a very natural fit. And I did that with family friends of ours that lived in the neighborhood.
So before you get to the majors where you're a nanny, you start out in the minor leagues as a mother's helper, right?
Exactly. You have to learn. You really do. And I have a wonderful mother, and I did not grow up with a nanny, but she really taught me all the all the magic there is to know. And she's the one who suggested that I spend time with the mothers of the children that I would eventually become their babysitter, eventually become their nanny, to learn what was going on in those families and to learn responsibility and to learn all the things that you don't maybe innately know as a child. And so that was a really great experience and really prepared me to become a nanny. And so after that, I did become a full-fledged babysitter and then a full-fledged nanny for a few different families in the neighborhood. And I did that all through high school, grammar school, high school. And then even when I went off to college, I ended up being the nanny for my professor's children. And then when I'd come back in the summer, I would go back to being the nanny for my previous children. So I was always a nanny all the time, and I loved it. And then I actually studied performance theater and communications in college, which is such an odd...
Well, where'd you go to college?
Combo. Well, you know what? In performance theater, I've always loved acting, and it really helped me also in the world of being a nanny because you use imagination so much, and so much of education is learned through thinking outside the box and through imagination and the whimsical things. And you also learn a lot about people when in being an actor because you're emoting all those different emotions and you're learning how to empathize with people, and so you learn a lot about children, people, about yourself, and that all really helped me be the nanny that I was. And so through a portion of adulthood, I also nannied, and then I went off to do other things after I retired, which is what I'm doing now. I have a video production company in Chicago. But what led me to then writing, I always knew I wanted to write a children's book. While I was a nanny, I always knew eventually I would do it because I did love to write. But I didn't want to force myself to sit down and write anything unless it was something that was very organic, it was something that was needed. So I started looking at the children's book market a few years ago and saw that there was really nothing that described a nanny. And more importantly, what happens when the parents go to work and who stays home with them. So I wanted to speak to that from my experience to help the children understand the transition, which oftentimes can be traumatic. They don't understand why there's a stranger, why their parents are leaving them. And the parents also have a lot of guilt, and they want to bring peace of mind to the family knowing that they're doing the right thing for their children. So that led me to write Nanny and Me.
Wow, we've got Florence Ann Romano on the phone calling in from Chicago, and her website appropriately is named Windy City Nanny. So specifically the book, because when Emily mentioned that we had an author as a potential guest, Nanny and Me, I didn't associate it with a children's book, which I think makes perfect sense because I think the content and the experience kids can really relate to. I was thinking more of all the kind of the modern day either controversy or kind of the economics of being a nanny, and you hear in all of the celebrity tabloids where there's been a big push in the last few years, be careful of nannies because, God, who are the people that... recently there was somebody who got divorced. Well, it happens all the time.
Gwen Stefani.
That was a nanny thing? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, also not the Spider-Man guy, but the Matt Damon friend guy, Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck, yes, that as well, and the late Robin Williams. That was also, I remember, one of the first things that came out.
Let's talk about the kids' book, Nanny and Me, and then let's talk about the People magazine version of Nanny and Me. We have Florence Ann Romano, who has been a professional nanny. She's worked in the industry from the minor leagues of mother's helper to babysitter to nanny. And talk about the book and who's the audience, and as a children's book, where it's available, and talk about a little bit of the response and what it was like writing a book, which I'm always fascinating about because I think there's a lot of work and it's a very creative endeavor. And then we'll talk about the industry in general of being a nanny.
Nanny and Me was great to write because it was really everything that was already written on my heart. It was about my experience with the children. And in writing it, I wanted to make sure that children understood why someone other than their parents was taking care of them. So it's told from the child's perspective on purpose, because the books that are out there about nannies aren't necessarily talking to the children, and the children really are the most important part of the equation. So I wanted the children to understand that this is a character in the book that they could relate to. It was something that was happening in this character's life that was mirroring their own, and that they could read this book with their parents, and then the peace of mind that's brought to the children is also brought to the parents as well, because there's something tangible there for them to use as a tool to explain the transition that's about to happen. And the parents can feel like they have a little bit more control over the situation, because there are a lot of emotions at play when it comes to leaving your children with a stranger, even if it's not a stranger, even if it's a relative or it's a next door neighbor, it's still someone new, still someone you're trusting with your most precious possessions. So that's why Nanny and Me was such an important book to write, because I saw firsthand the guilt the parents had, the nervous nature of leaving them with children, then also children needing to have an explanation. And what's interesting about the world today, there is such a stigma with nannies about, oh gosh, they're going to cheat with your husband, they're going to cheat with your wife, you know, that you know, you can't hire a hot nanny, you can't do anything like that, you know, it's not safe. And it's such an interesting evolution of the word nanny, because when most people think of it, they think it's just the upper echelon of society that has a nanny, and those people aren't taking care of their children. Well, today, the statistic is 60% of children in America, families in America, have a nanny or a caretaker. 60%. Hmm. And that statistic rises in line with the employment rate. So what we're seeing is not trendy. We're seeing something that's a behavior of society, and it's not going anywhere. And this is hardworking, middle-class families in America that have both parents working in the home. Sometimes it's a single-family home, whatever the case may be. But we're seeing that someone else is there loving and caring for your child. And that's what I want to break the mold about and really start a national conversation about is, it's a good thing to have someone out there helping raise your child. To surround children with as much love and protection as you possibly can, what a gift to give to your children. But it takes time to figure out who that right person is in your life to play that role, and who also is going to be a good role model for your children in your absence, as well as be an extension of the values of your family. So that plays in then to the stigma, the stereotype in society today, the things that you see splashed across People magazine about all these celebrities cheating with their nannies. And that's really not a great representation of what's going on in the world. It's gossip. You know, it's not gossip, but it is at the same time, because people want to talk about anything that's salacious. And it's exciting because it's celebrity and you want to buy that magazine to read it. I'm not saying it doesn't happen in families. It most certainly does, but it's not the majority. And it definitely shouldn't be how we define a nanny, because there are so many out there that are doing right, that they actually have a good moral compass and that they're in it for the right reasons and they're taking care of the children.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything about the profession of being a nanny that indexes higher or lower relative to morality or ethics. I just think it's more visible. But, you know, we've got Deb and Emily here, and I wanted to get them to weigh in a little bit. What for Deb, with your family and Emily, you know, when you were younger, did you guys do babysitting? Did you ever have a nanny? And it feels like everyone has stories about babysitters and nannies, and I want to share mine in a sec, but I wanted to see, do either of you guys work in babysitting or having a nanny?
I did not.
Nothing.
Nothing. It was not an area of interest for me ever. And we did not ever have a babysitter because my mother was
stay at home.
In the home. Yeah.
Perfect. You ever babysit there, Emily?
I actually didn't. The neighborhood I grew up in, all the kids were the same age. So by the time I was babysitting age, nobody needed babysitting.
There was nobody left.
And I actually have a similar situation with my home life. My mom and my parents worked out a schedule where someone was always home because that was financially easier for them.
So you grew up kind of free range?
Yeah.
Like, you were out with
like chickens out in the country.
Well, I wasn't going to say chickens. I was going to say My experience, we've got Florence Ann Romano. She is the author of Nanny and Me. And her website is WindyCityNanny.com, and Twitter is Florence Ann CHI, and she's on Facebook. When years ago, I have Florence Ann, my wife and I have three kids, and for our youngest, who are now 15 and 16, there was a period when I was traveling a lot about a decade ago, and so we had, it wouldn't be a full-time live-in nanny, we didn't go full Ben Affleck, but there was a person who came in who was the nanny. And it's a different thing. When you go from babysitter, I think most parents are familiar with the babysitter paradigm where it's either a neighborhood kid or somebody and you say, hey, can you come in Friday night from 6 to 9? And you pay him $5 or $10 an hour, depending on when it was. But a nanny is like they're in your house. They're in your kitchen. They're in your laundry, which for me is a little traumatic. You know, other people handling my laundry. But there's an emotional connection, I think, not only with kids, but also having another adult, in many cases, young adult, in a house, which in itself is very private, and it's an intimate place. You've got bathrooms, kitchens, you know. And so that was a little bit of an adjustment. And we were lucky, and we had two young ladies as nannies. And there was a time when we took the name, we didn't have two like simultaneously. Mm-hmm. That would be full Ben Affleck or that would be full celebrity. But I'm talking about sequentially, where we took one of the nannies to Maui because the kids were little. And I didn't, I said to my wife, Katie, we really have to take the nanny on the road trip? And it's like, oh, it'll be nice. We can go out to eat. We can do stuff. But my daughter at the time, who's got a very feisty personality, she made the nanny cry. And not in a literal way, but in kind of a kid way, she was like the nanny killer, nanny slayer. And because she was strong, but did you ever have experiences yourself, Florence Ann, where, you're playing an important role as a caregiver, but you're not the parent, but there's areas of discipline that you're required to do. But if the kid knows you can only go so far, kind of like, hey, you're the nanny, you know. Yeah, you've got limited powers. How do you kind of straddle the role of being an effective nanny, and then having the kid turn on you and say, "You're not the boss of me, nanny."
You took the words right out of my mouth. My little sister used to say that all the time when I would babysit her. You're not the boss of me. I said I should write a book called You're Not the Boss of Me. But it's a fine line, truthfully, discipline when it comes to the children, because you also have to remember you aren't their parent, but the word discipline is defined differently by every family. And that's something that a nanny and the parents need to have a conversation about right from the get-go. They need to define discipline. Does that mean they are allowed to spank your child? Does that mean they're allowed to ground your child? You know, do they tell them no? I mean, what is it? I mean, you have to define that, and it's different for every family. But for me, being a nanny, I never found discipline to be too hard of a problem, because if there was ever an issue, I would be able to talk about it with the children, or I would go to the parents and they would be able to handle it from there. I was very lucky. They hardly ever acted out or didn't want to listen to me. They were very well-behaved children. And if there ever was a squabble of some kind, it took me more just being able to talk it out with the kids about what was bothering them. Usually it's never about the thing they're acting out about. That's what you find. It's usually about something else. But I've cried before being a nanny, not because the children have done something to anger me or upset me, but because I've worried about the kids. There's a particular story that I was caring for one of the girls that I'd been with for a long time, since she was a little girl, and now she was grown up and in school and in grammar school and almost starting high school, truthfully. And her parents were very, very strict. Education was very important to her parents, and I understood that. And I would do her homework with her, and golly, I was just, there was nothing I could help with, truthfully. She was teaching me all the time. But I would see her struggle with making sure that she was perfect and she was great and she was getting the best grades. And it got to the point where she would make herself sick about disappointing her parents, and I'd be in the bathroom with her while she threw up. And it broke my heart, and I could not deal with it anymore. So I went to the parents and had a very constructive conversation. I never was attacking them about anything, but I needed to tell them what I was seeing and how hurtful it was to see her doing that to herself, and that we needed to find a way to help her get through school and know that she could have some self-esteem and have some confidence and not be afraid of disappointing her parents. And so we did have that conversation, and it was very productive, and things did end up changing because they weren't necessarily aware of what was going on. But nannies see sometimes what the parents don't. And that's why it's important that nannies do have an open relationship with the parents, where they can communicate about the things that they're seeing, and that they also have trust with the children.
Right. We have Florence Ann Romano, author of the book Nanny and Me, children's book. I'm guessing it's available on Amazon and online, right?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere, and also from my website.
Well, fantastic. Talk about, I mean, one of the things that I don't think gets discussed as much about being a nanny as opposed to the salacious details is that at some point the nanny relationship or the assignment ends, and whether it's a one-year thing, a six-month thing, or many times it's a prolonged role that is played for 4 years, 5 years, until maybe the kid is in school. There has to be a whole psychology of what happens when the nanny relationship ends, because for many kids with nannies, with two parents working possibly where the parents are outside of the home, the nanny plays not just a supervisory role, but a profound role as one of the closest adults to a young child's life. From your experience, either with kids that you worked with or from what you've heard in the industry, you know, how does that typically play out? And are there real issues with when, you know, or maybe the next book could be when the nanny leaves, or like, you know, where's the nanny? Where is, you know, nanny Florence Ann? And how does that typically work out?
Leaving the home is unbelievably difficult. When I retired from being a nanny, the stars kind of all aligned for the next chapter of my life to begin. But the catalyst for it was that the family that I was with, whom only had one little girl at the time, they were moving, and they were moving too far away. And that had to end my time with them. And in my book, the last line is, "Though our time has come to part, you are always in my heart." And that is actually a line that I put on a jewelry box that I had made for the little girl so she would always remember me. And to this day, I still stay in touch with every single child for which I nannied. I go to their prom pictures. I go to their graduations. I go out to dinner now with them, you know, the ones who are older. It's an unbelievable relationship that's continued. I still think of them as my little kids and love them dearly, and they will still introduce me to people as their nanny, and I'm like, but you're taller than me. It's just unbelievable. So leaving the family can be so traumatic. I bawled my eyes out when I left the last little girl I was with. And it is something that nannies and parents have to talk to the children about. The wind, you stay until the wind changes, is what I always say. And that's something from Mary Poppins. And the wind changes in every family for different reasons. It could be moving, the children grow up, whatever the case may be. But if the children are old enough, you need to have a conversation with them about this change. And truthfully, it's probably more traumatic for the parents than it is for the children, because they have to find someone new, or they've grown so attached to having that help. There is a lot of emotion at play with that. So that's why I do suggest parents sitting down and talking to their children about that transition as well. The transition in and the transition out are both equally important. And it's most important to make sure the children know that no matter what the reason is the nanny is leaving, that it's not because they did anything wrong, that they love them, they are wonderful children, and that they will always have that nanny in their life. And it's just going to be in a different way. And if you can make sure that you're having open communication with your children about that and that they feel safe talking to you about their feelings, then it's going to be win-win.
Great. In our last couple of minutes, we have Florence Ann Romano. She is the author of Nanny and Me and also CEO of Original Six Media. Her website is windycitynanny.com. So in the last couple of minutes, for parents listening or grandparents, talk a little bit about what advice you would give to a young person, young adult. And we didn't talk about male versus female nannies, but if somebody was, you know, many young people are exposed to being a babysitter by a neighbor or a relative saying, hey, can you come over and watch our kids? I don't know if it's usually a strategic, thought out kind of path. But for somebody, for young people who are thinking, yeah, I want to be, you know, the minor league would be mother's helper. Then I want to be a babysitter. And then I may want to professionally be a nanny either for a longer period or during a gap year after high school. Talk about the business and kind of the mindset that you think is effective to get into it. And we only have about a minute and a half. So if you can kind of give advice for people thinking about it, that would be helpful.
It has to come from your heart. It has to be something you truly, truly love. And you have to love children. You have to know that you have what it takes to be a good role model in that family and be an extension of that family, no matter what the values are. I always say, if we don't agree, it's not for me. During the first interview, you need to make sure you're on the same page with that family about what's going to happen. The onboarding is so important. So anyone that's considering it, it has to come from your heart. It has to be the most important decision of your life, truthfully, because you have the lives of children in your hands, and you are going to be someone that loves and protects them and is going to be their role model. So make sure you take it seriously. It's not just a job. It's a profession.
What about training? I know, you know, whether it's CPR, and as you go from babysitter, which is typically inside the house for a period, to nanny, sometimes you're also taking kids out in a car, you have car seats. That's a whole other issue of kind of being prepared and being professional, right?
If you're with an agency, they should be training you for those different situations that you might be in. But it's also up to you, the nanny, to make sure that you're educated in the way that you need to be educated to care for that family, especially if they have special needs children. You need to know how to care for that child. And that's no different from caring from any other child. It's a customized relationship with each one.
Final question, nanny cams, good or bad?
Absolutely your choice. If it makes you feel comfortable, then go for it, and you don't have to tell them. You should have nothing to hide. That's always what I tell nannies. You should always participate in life and with those children like you have nothing to hide.
So, you know, you're down with the Meet the Parents nanny cam and the stuffed bear up on the third shelf in the library?
If that's going to bring you peace of mind when you're away from your children, then absolutely do it. It's really up to you, because it's about the safety of those children.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for calling in and being part of the show. I'm fascinated by the book that you've written and how you've focused it as a kid's book. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It is called Nanny and Me by Florence Ann Romano. Her website is windycitynanny.com, and she's visible on Facebook and also Twitter. Thank you so much for calling in. We will look forward to talking to you again sometime. And thank you, Florence Ann.
I would love it. Such a pleasure.
Thank you. You've been listening to our interview with Florence Ann Romano, the author of Nanny and Me and also CEO of Original Six Media, calling in from Chicago, also known as the Windy City. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5 FM.